Okay, we're working our way through American Christian history, and we use the word Christian in air quotes there, because a lot of times the people that are involved in this, they claim to be Christians, but when you really look at it, they're not. A good example of that is the first guy they're going to mention this morning. He is one of three names that I remember my major professor at Ozark always ripped on. He felt that there were three key people that really contributed to the loss of focus on biblical Christianity in American history. And he kind of grew up during this time period we're looking at right now. And this would be one of the guys he really ripped on a lot. Harry Emerson Fosdick. This is all about the continuation of the liberal versus fundamentalist controversy that came out of the late 1800s into the early 1900s. If you don't remember, I'm going to refresh you, okay? During the latter portion of the 1800s, we had basically an invasion of liberal European thought that took over all the universities that had at one time been preacher training schools in the United States. And from that beachhead, they started spreading liberalism all over the United States. And the fundamentalists began as an aggressive response to that. And they had five key fundamentals that they believed in that needed to be upheld from the scripture. And that's how they got their name. They did a lot of publication. And as the media changed over to radio, they also got involved in that. And that is why this guy despises the fundamentalists, because he sees them as a hindrance to the progressive era. Remember, progressivism was all about the idea that the government is good. The bigger it is, the better it is. The government is going to help us move into a better era. And Christianity needed to change and evolve with the times. And so when this guy saw that the fundamentalists were hindering that progress, he preached a sermon entitled, "Shall the Fundamentalists Win?" Harry Emerson Fosdick, he was at First Presbyterian Church in New York City in 1922. Later, he was part of an American Baptist Association. This particular group of Baptists are very liberal. And every once in a while, I run across one of them, and always surprises me that they're that liberal and carry the Baptist name. But here's some of the excerpts from the sermon. "This morning we are to think of the fundamentalist controversy which threatens to divide the American churches as though already they were not sufficiently split and riven. Already all of us must have heard about the people who call themselves the fundamentalists. Their apparent intention is to drive out of the evangelical churches men and women of liberal opinions. I speak of them the more freely because there are no two denominations more affected by them than the Baptist and the Presbyterian. We should not identify the fundamentalists with the conservatives. All fundamentalists are conservatives, but not all conservatives are fundamentalists. The best conservatives can often give lessons to the liberals in true liberality of spirit, but the fundamentalist program is essentially illiberal and intolerant." Now, you think that whole tolerant movement started in the modern era. It did not. This idea that they needed to be accepting of all opinions and all of that, it started way back at this time. "The fundamentalists see, and they see truly, that in this last generation there have been strange new movements in Christian thought. A great mass of new knowledge has come into man's possession. New knowledge about the physical universe, its origin, its forces, its laws. New knowledge about human history, and in particular about the ways in which the ancient peoples used to think in matters of religion and methods by which they phrased and explained their spiritual experiences. And new knowledge also about other religions and the strangely similar ways in which men's faiths and religious practices have developed everywhere. So remember, in the colleges and the universities, they had sucked up on this idea of evolution. They accepted it not just simply in their idea of physical science, that man evolved from a common ancestor with apes way back in time, but they accepted that religion evolved as well. That it used to be that, you know, the hunter-gatherers would develop a very basic religion where they thought there were spirits in all the different trees and in the different types of streams and things like that. And then gradually over time, as their society evolved into tight-knit communities where they didn't all forage, they actually started doing trading and things like that, that religion evolved as well. Mm-hmm. Oh, these guys here? Okay. Probably about the same in a lot of respects. The liberalism that started here maintains control of all the universities that they seized back at this time. Yale, Harvard, Princeton, all the divinity schools that are connected to those particular universities are all basically liberal. They believe and teach that the Bible is just another of many religious books. The Christian religion evolved just like the Jewish religion and just like Buddhism and all of these things. That's why they teach comparative religion in a lot of these schools. And they talk about mythology and how Christianity is just another of the world mythologies. So that's all starting right here. And that's what Fosdick is referencing here, is that all came into play in the late 1800s, and it was being embraced except by those nasty fundamentalists. They were causing trouble by not accepting the truth about the evolution of all things. Here's another line, or another paragraph. Now, there are multitudes of reverent Christians who have been unable to keep this new knowledge in one compartment of their minds and the Christian faith in another. Now, what he's expressing here is he believes the fundamentalists won't allow the new sciences to break into their belief in a literal, inspired Bible. That good people allow it to change their Christianity. Now, keep listening. They have been sure that all truth comes from the one God and in His revelation, meaning the Bible. Not, therefore, from irreverence or caprice or destructive zeal, but for the sake of intellectual and spiritual integrity, that they might really love the Lord their God, not only with all their heart and soul and strength, but with all their mind. They have been trying to see this new knowledge in terms of the Christian faith and to see the Christian faith in terms of this new knowledge. So he was saying the fundamentalists won't allow themselves to evolve with the times. But the rest of us Christians, we evolved. We broke down that wall in our brains that separated Christianity from everything else. And so we decided to start looking at how God, the spirit of the universe, was somehow involved in evolution. And how it's not about the salvation of men's souls, but rather the salvation of people in general as part of the human race that Christianity should be focused. So the social gospel was his big deal. The next couple of things I wrote in here is because he was talking so much, it's hard to really condense it down. So he specifically criticized the fundamentalists for insisting on belief in the virgin birth of Christ, the inspiration of the scriptures, the substitutionary atonement, and a literal second coming. Now, those are four of the five fundamentals, remember. So he makes it very plain where he thinks the battle lines are drawn. If you believe in that mythology of the virgin birth, you're a fundamentalist and you are a problem. If you believe that the Bible is, in fact, inspired by the divine God, then you are a fundamentalist and you are a problem with progress. If you believe that Jesus died for sins, rather than just simply he died because he was a revolutionary, that he was teaching things that those people didn't like, then you're a fundamentalist and you're a problem. And if you believe that Jesus is coming back again, literally, to establish an eternal kingdom with only those who accept the other things that we just talked about, then you're a fundamentalist and you are causing problems for the rest of us because you won't evolve with the times. Yep. Yeah. Religion is a function of the community. It helps you feel good about yourself and others, and it encourages you to look out for the progression of the human race. See, because it's all about it's not about the individual, it's about the race. It needs to progress into the future and survive. Because, you know, that's the whole evolutionary principle. Evolution is not about the individual. It's about the DNA pool needs to move forward. And if you are an impediment to that, then you should be happy to be removed out of it so that it can be better. Oh, Dewey would have been definitely sucked into all this stuff. Yeah, he was a progressive. Oh, yeah. Progressivism was the core of the new educational principles. It was to try to separate people from fundamentalist concepts and give them progressive movement into this new way of thinking about things, where, again, it's not about the individual, it's about the group. It's groupthink. And the fundamentalists were one of the few groups that actually kind of fought against this garbage. Liberals had in their own minds outgrown these superstitious aspects of Christianity, and they'd more appropriately embraced the progressive concept of the social gospel. So that was Fosdick's belief, is that we liberals, or better, progressives, are trying to move us forward into looking out for the larger group. And so that's why we're going to, you know, promote the welfare state, because we want to help people have a place to live and a place and food, and the government is going to be best at doing that. See, this is the era in which churches began cooperating more with the government doing this sort of stuff than they doing it themselves. In large part because, and just think about this, the conservative churches to this day evaluate the situation of the individual before handing out benevolence. Because they're thinking beyond the here and now. They're thinking about, well, how can I help this person get over the problem and get into a relationship with Jesus Christ, rather than just simply putting a Band-Aid on it. You know, giving them some money or, you know, handing them a welfare check or something like that. So Fosdick is definitely a big government guy. Now, in his conclusion, he clearly indicates he does not want fundamentalists to win. Remember, that was the title of this, Shall the Fundamentalists Win? Well, he doesn't want them to. The present world's situation smells to heaven, and now in the presence of colossal problems which must be solved in Christ's name and for Christ's sake, the fundamentalists propose to drive out from the Christian churches all the consecrated souls who do not agree with their theory of inspiration. What immeasurable folly. So the fundamentalists were actually trying to purge their congregations of liberals. And they were also trying to purge them out of any of their teaching structures. And so that's what Fosdick is complaining about. He's saying, these guys are trying to get rid of all of us that are trying to move the human race forward. And that's not good. We've got to stop them from being able to do that. Well, they are not going to do it. Certainly not in this vicinity, that, you know, New York. By the way, one of the famous members of the congregation where he preached was Rockefeller, J.D. Rockefeller. Anyway, I do not even know in this congregation whether anybody's been tempted to be a fundamentalist. Never in this church have I caught one accent of intolerance. God keep us always so, and ever increasingly areas of the Christian fellowship intellectually hospitable, open-minded, liberty-loving, fair, tolerant, not with the toleration of indifference as though we did not care about the faith, but because always our major emphasis is upon the weightier matters of the law. And see, you notice he quotes there from Scripture, but he grabs it for his own purposes. And that's also very common with this, is the progressives will quote from Scripture when it serves their purposes. If the wording serves their purposes. Not necessarily the context, just the wording. That's all it takes. You know, like the whole blessed are the peacemakers thing? Even the UN grabs hold of that one and uses it. But that is not what Jesus meant when he said that. But it doesn't matter to them. Because you see, it's just man-made words anyway. The Bible is a man-made book expressing religious ideals, philosophical ideals, and you grab a hold of the ones that are good for your purposes, and the rest you just blow off. Especially if it's intolerant. Especially if it's old-fashioned. Now, that should help you understand why in the modern era, today, there are tons of churches that continue this exact practice with all sorts of liberal concepts. They will rail on the idea that if you accept what the Bible says literally, then you are intolerant and you are not modern thinking, you are not being helpful. You're being hurtful and hateful by being caught in the past. And they will use whatever they want from the Bible to suit their purposes and throw the rest in the dustbin of history. Okay? So any questions or comments on that? Fosdick is a very good example of the time period's hatred of fundamentalism. And it gets repeated in the modern time. Oh, yeah. Yes. This time period in the early 1900s is the big shift over to the majority of the churches in the United States being liberal. There's just no doubt about it. They'll refer to themselves as mainstream or mainline because they are in the majority. And some of them have pedigrees that go back to the colonial days. But they have abandoned Bible Christianity. But that doesn't matter to them because Bible Christianity just needed to be, you know, progressed. And so it's always interesting to run across one of these people and hear them talk about, you know, true Christianity is their viewpoint. That's their belief system. That the rest of us are the ones that are like, we're throwbacks. And we're a bunch of troublemakers, just like those fundamentalists in Islam that want to go back to the killing days. See, what you see in the description of Islam today, that's the same thing that was happening at this time. It is that the liberals try to couch everything about how they're the main line, and the fundamentalists are the ones that are out in, you know, the far right field. When in fact it's the other way around. The conservatives represent true historical biblical Christianity. And the radical fundamentalists of Islam represent true Quranic Islam. And I don't know what the percentages are, it's probably very, very close. In Islam, about 10% of the Islamic population are true conservatives. they really believe the Quran should be looked at as the word of God. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised. It's probably about the same ratio within Christianity. Oh, yeah, yeah. And that is very common today. There was some sort of survey that was made, and one of the options of people that you might have as a neighbor was a fundamentalist Christian, and very few people wanted to have fundamentalist Christians as their neighbor. Fundamentalists are looked down on. And if you haven't figured that out, then apparently you're not, you know, paying attention, because they are not liked in our society. All right, so we talked a little bit about the Scopes so-called monkey trial last week. Now, that took place in Tennessee in 25, and it really was all about the whole fundamentalist versus progressive thing again. But it really did just kind of light the fuse for the takeover of the schools by the progressives over the next several decades, until by the 1960s, with some Supreme Court decisions, progressivism did take over the schools. And any type of biblical Christianity is barred from making its way back into the schools today. So much so that there have been lawsuits about whether or not a teacher can have a Bible unopened laying on his desk during the school day. And the court said, no, he may not. Because the students may take from that a belief that Christianity was being promoted by that teacher. And that's very problematic. But it starts in this time period where the hatred of anything biblical is really pushed forward. Now, the Roaring Twenties were also the period when Prohibition took place. And, of course, Christianity was involved in that. Now, for most of you, I think you're going to find out it's the reverse of what you would expect. It was the liberal Christians that pushed Prohibition. The Bible-believing Christians said, why should we be involved in that? Why should the government be involved in that? That should be a matter of individual choice. And the progressives were the ones that believed the government should make such big decisions for the people, for the people's benefit. And I gave you a couple of quotes here. I'm not going to go through them all, but Amy Simple McPherson, she was a Pentecostal revivalist in the 20s. Now remember, Pentecostalism didn't start until the beginning of the 1900s. And so she was very popular, and when she was asked about the whole Prohibition thing, she said it really probably wasn't a good idea, that you should teach by example, not by law, I think is what she eventually comes down to. Billy Sunday was also very active during this time period. He was a baseball star turned revivalist, and he also indicated he didn't think Prohibition was really being helpful. And neither was it when the government, you know, took it away and put taxes on stuff. He didn't think that was really being all that helpful either to the issue. I love the way he wraps this up, though. At the end of it, he says, it doesn't take a lawyer to figure out that if you do that, you keep that much money out of legitimate channels you create, you spend that much less for food and clothes and boots and shoes and education and automobiles. He was talking about the government said, we're going to put a tax on hard liquor and we're going to be able to bring money in to the federal government. See, this is the beginning of the sin tax idea. You tax stuff so that you can generate revenue. The only problem is you tax that which you want to quash. You tax that which you want to limit. And so you really can't look at the taxing of anything as a revenue generation device, because you're going to cause people to quit doing whatever it is Yes, he was not about evolution. He did not like it either. On the soda tax? Well, it depends on how long it'll be in place, whether or not it'll make it. But oh, have they already? Well, here's the finish of his quote. Oh, America didn't need repeal. She needed repentance. She didn't need wrong. She needed righteousness. We don't need JAGS. We need Jesus. JAGS apparently are smart people. We don't need more grog. We need more God. And he was really into alliteration and stuff. So just kind of cool that the conservatives of the period tended to think that the prohibition was a bad idea, that it really didn't address the issue. Because the only way that you really truly address the issue is you deal with the individuals, not the larger group. And I noted on here some of the other unintended consequences of the Prohibition era. You know these. You've heard about these in school. Organized crime came into existence because of Prohibition, because they saw that there was money to be made off of illicit liquor. The public accepted drinking among women in all these little speakeasies and these blind pigs. Did you know they were called blind pigs sometimes? What had happened is you'd go to the door and you'd knock on it, and somebody would answer the door and said, I came to see the blind pig. And that was your code word for being allowed to go in to the little private area where they sold the liquor. Okay? It was weird. But anyway, in those establishments, heavy drinking by women, which had not really been an issue before, started becoming an issue. And then, of course, you got the worsening of alcoholism that happens because with Prohibition coming into existence, all the support groups dried up because they thought we won't be needed anymore. Because if you stop selling it, nobody's going to drink it, so nobody's going to have the problem, so we don't need to exist. And so once Prohibition was in place and drinking continued, there was no support for the people that were sucked into it. Plus, it was, you know, supposed to be illegal, so you didn't really talk about if you had a problem drinking. So it was a big failed social experiment where the government thought they could move the entire population forward into something that was good for them. Just out of curiosity, can you figure in your mind anything that the government is currently involved in trying to force people to improve themselves? Sugary drinks, we just talked about that a little while ago. What? Tobacco? It's been involved in the tobacco thing for a long, long time. You said marijuana a little while ago, and the idea was if you can't make it illegal, then you tax it heavily, right? Yep, and that's just more of this post-prohibition stuff. How about the fact that California is particularly big in progressive stuff like this? Taxes on snack foods. You know, they actually did away with trans fat foods, I think, in California. You can't have trans fat in any of the foods out there. So they're basically saying, we tell you what's good for you. Did you? That's right. Plastic bags are the next big thing. Yeah, if you didn't bring your own bags, tough. There will not be bags given to you unless you want to buy one of our recyclable ones, you know, or one of our reusable ones. Deb, did you want to? Yeah, they can't right now. But remember, you and I have this joke going on where people almost always say, there ought to be a law, right? And that is the progressive mindset, is the government needs to do something to fix this issue. And so that is always problematic when they stick their nose in where it does not belong. And by the way, a lot of our founding fathers would have a fit about progressivism, because it goes against the principles they had in mind. Oh, Obamacare, that's right. Whether you want it or not, you must have insurance. Okay, and it has to be a specific type of insurance. In fact, we'll only give you three choices. Or we will tax you extra money to penalize you until you submit. That's right. Because that's the other use of taxes, is to penalize you in such a way that you feel, okay, fine, I'll give up and I'll do what you want me to do. Yeah. The opioids, yeah. Yep. And see, and but this is going to be a government thing, and that is part of the progressive mindset: is the government needs to be involved in every aspect of your life. Now, page 3 on the notes, as the 20s continued into the 30s, you have to understand the impact that new tech has on this stuff. You've got the steam trains and steamships that come into existence in the 1800s. That makes movement across this continent in particular, since we're thinking about America, much quicker. Then you've got automobiles getting produced and commercial air travel following shortly after World War I. So in the 1920s and 30s, all that's happening. And so Americans are becoming more and more mobile and more industrialized. More and more they are in the cities rather than being in the countries or in the countryside. So this naturally happens anyway. In every culture, where they become more and more focused on city living, you have to have tech that allows you to do that. Even the Romans used high tech of their era to allow them to live in very densely populated cities, such as Rome. Rome had about somewhere between 750 to a million people living in it. The only reason that was allowed was because they had a aqueduct system that brought fresh water on a regular basis. They actually had a sewer system that took away all the waste. It took it into the Tiber River, so you didn't want to go swimming in the Tiber River. They had garbage pickup, and they had fire brigades, and they had all of these things to allow them to live in densely populated cities. But guess what happens when their tech tree collapsed? Their civilization fell apart too. So that after the Roman Empire kind of fell apart, Rome dropped its population down to a few tens of thousands from almost a million. And that almost always happens. But you have the buildup first. And so that's kind of what happened in the 20s and the 30s, is the United States started building up its more dense population centers. How many of you heard about this? I can't even think of the name of it now. Something about 21. Agenda 21. It's all about getting people to move into more densely populated cities and getting them to use public transportation and things like that. For them, they believe it's the better use of resources. And it's the government that's promoting all of this. I'm going to give you my opinion on it. I believe it gives more control over the people to have them densely populated and not allowing them to grow their own groceries and things like that. Do you know in some states now you have to apply for a license to have a garden? Yep. Because you see, you cannot be trusted to raise things that are good for you. And if the government's not involved in inspecting all of that, then that could be problematic. You are in several states now. You cannot catch rain off your roof or off your property. Because you see, you are depriving people downstream of that. And that is a resource for everybody, not for you. Okay? That's right, under little grow lamps in the basement with the darkened windows. That's exactly right. And then, of course, the electrical company will rat you out because you're using more energy than you should be, and they'll be raiding your house. Well, but again, it's the idea, in this progressive era, it was the groupthink, and it continues into the modern period. You realize, of course, Western states that have very little water because of the natural drop-off of, you know, the rain system coming over the Rockies. Those people that are living in all those desert regions and turn them into cities are now saying, hey, you people out there by the Great Lakes, you got to let us put a pipeline in so that we can have your water, because it's actually all our water. And so they want to tap into the Great Lakes and drop them by a few tens of feet while they sap off some of that water for themselves. Did you know that? Any of you aware of that? Yeah. We'll see whether or not that happens. But anyway, 1930s, what's that? We'll charge them big for it. 1930s, you got two-thirds of American homes now have electricity. And so you got a lot of labor-saving devices that are starting to be bought. By the 30s, a half of American homes had telephones, so it was a lot easier to stay in touch. That's why, because of these things, chain stores, advertising campaigns, all of that gets started right around this time period. Spectator sports becomes a big deal during this time. Seems a little bit like Rome with their circuses. Not like animal acts, but the circuses where people did combat contests because there were so many people unemployed, they had to keep them occupied. Radio was originally envisioned as a means for the government and education and business to communicate with the American people with a view imparting progressive ideals. Did you know that? That was the original intent of radio, to help the government and business and education push progressivism. But guess what? Christianity, particularly the fundamentalists, went, whoa, new technology, let's grab hold of that, because we can reach a lot of people with our message. That did not go over well with the progressives. They do not like it when fundamentalists start using technology to get their message out. This is where the little footnote comes in handy. This is from 1925 Current Opinion. It's called Religion's Raid on Radio. Quote, "It is bad enough to have different religious denominations preaching against each other and working against each other, all in the name of the same God, within the walls of their own meeting houses. In that case, we do not have to listen to them unless we choose to. But if they get to competing in the air, we broadcast listeners will be out of luck. Already the fundamentalists and their opponents have had their fling in the ether, and a large part of listening America had a bad attack of spiritual nausea. So long as power is limited so that the propagandizing stations can be tuned out, the situation is tolerable. The radio manufacturer and dealer especially are not adverse to a condition that requires a high degree of selectivity in receiving sets. But when a broadcaster acquires a right to radiate an amount of power that will focus oscillations in all receivers within 5, 10, or 50 miles for any number of hours, he may choose to monopolize the ether. He will have reached the ideal of the religious fanatic and the point where the average listener will junk his receiving set." Now, what you don't understand about that is this. When radio first started getting used, there were no controls about how powerful you could make your station. And so what would happen is, if you had the money, you just pumped up the juice on your station and you wiped out all the competition in your area. You just totally blew them off. And so that was what some of the fundamentalists were apparently doing. They'd get on these blowtorch stations that just radiated such power that nobody else could compete in the area for it. So these guys didn't like that. So guess what they come up with? Federal Communications Commission, which limits bandwidth, power, what you can broadcast during which times and all of that. So it's another example of there ought to be a law. The government ought to do something about this. And so that's when the FCC came into existence, is in the 30s. And part of it was because some of these progressives felt like the fundamentalists were getting too far ahead in the messaging to the communities. Hollywood, of course, also gets into the play right here with film. And Hollywood was not policed at the very beginning. They put on screen whatever they wanted to put on screen. And so Christians started complaining about that because they felt like there was some bad stuff out there. And so the screen people decided we need to do something before the government does something. So they hired a Presbyterian church elder by the name of William H. Hayes to help them clean up their public image. And so he gave them a whole bunch of suggestions as to how they could self-police so that the government wouldn't step in on behalf of the people. And you've got on the bottom of the page there, on the second half of the page, some of the things that was recommended to them, which remained in place until the lives of most of us sitting here today. Profanity that included or even lipped the words of God, Lord, Jesus, Christ, hell, damn, God, unless, you know, there was some sort of religious content to those words, that was, shouldn't appear on the screen. That was what this guy told them. If you've got licentious or suggestive nudity in fact or in silhouette, which had already actually happened on the screens previous to this, then that needed to be stopped. Illegal traffic in drugs. Any type of inference of sexual perversion. White slavery. Miscegenation, which is basically interaction between different ethnic groups, you know, black and white in particular. Just as a question for you, do you know what the first black-white kiss, which program black-white kiss happened on United States TV? It was TV. You don't know? Yeah, it was Star Trek. It was between Spock and Uhura. It was funny. Anyway, but I guess they probably got away with it because it was between a Vulcan and a woman. So, what's that? Yeah, he's not really human, so that didn't probably count. What? He had green blood, so that's right. So they couldn't have sex hygiene or venereal diseases. Now, you might look at that and go, what? Well, Margaret Sanger was actually putting out material around this time about sexual diseases and also birth control and things like that. And so this guy was warning them, you probably need to get a hold of that before the Christians get out of control. If you show an actual childbirth in fact or in silhouette, that was not to be allowed, he didn't think. Children's sex organs, so little kids running around naked. Ridicule of the clergy was not supposed to be allowed. And willful offense of any nation, race, or creed. So that's what he originally suggested to them they needed to watch out for in order to keep the Christians from urging the Congress to put controls on them. Now the next page goes through a whole bunch of other things that he recommended. And a lot of this held sway right up until the 50s and 60s. Most of you remember that in the television shows, now this is all about movies, but television also followed these standards that were, it was a self-policing thing. But you remember growing up and seeing that nobody, husbands and wives didn't sleep in the same bed. Because that was suggested that that would be a bad idea by this guy. Because it might make people think that, you know, about sex. And of course, you never talked about being pregnant. I was trying to remember that there was something else that they used instead. in a family way. There we go. That was one of the ways that they would avoid the word pregnant on television. But this was all put in place because Hollywood was concerned that it would be worse if the government stepped in and policed them. So they did their own policing. And that has been the case up until pretty much the modern era. Have they kept up these rules anymore? No. Even on broadcast television, they pretty much do anything they want to except full nudity. And that's about the only thing I think they avoid still. The 20s also, of course, gave root to the big crash. This progressive time period was also a time when people were pushing the idea of spend, improve, invest. Everything's looking great. And this exuberance in finances eventually popped because they basically made a huge bubble. They made everything, you know, paper value, but not true value. And you can't do that for a very long time. And I should remind you that that's actually where we're at again. Now, I know there's a lot of people that are all excited about how big the stock market is right now. Folks, it is overvalued. It is way overvalued. And a lot of that stuff does not represent the truth on the ground for the value of those companies. And it was exactly what was going on in the 20s. Never a good choice. And so that's why a lot of people are expecting that we'll probably see another big crash. It's also one of the reasons why you got the government trying to maintain control on the situation through continually printing new money and stuff like that through the Federal Reserve, keeping interest rates unnaturally low. If they ever let go and natural things took effect, then you'd probably see something exactly what happened in the last part of the 30s, or last part of the 20s into the 30s. But this is what happened when it did pop. The government needs to do something, right? Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he comes in with, in my opinion, the high-handedness of the government and started spending more money on government projects. Some of it, yeah, there was public benefit, but others of them were make work projects. And trying to just keep the economy moving whether the project was needed or not. And Roosevelt, by the way, was another one of the guys that my professor always harped about. Fosdick, Roosevelt, and there was one other guy, and all of a sudden I've lost him in my head, but these guys that are always pushing, government is good, you need to let the government take care of you from cradle to grave. And if anything happens, then the government needs to come in and save you. When the hurricane happened in New Orleans and ripped it apart, what did the people want? They wanted the government to come in and fix it, right? If there is an earthquake out in California, what do they want? Government to come in and fix it, okay? And that is a natural outgrowth of the progressive time period that we've been looking at here. The government becomes God in the lives of the people. And it is promoted in the progressive churches as well. Do you know where they have voting drives? In progressive churches. Because they want people to come along and put their trust in the government more than in God. Because they don't believe God can be trusted, because God is just he's just a man-made concept anyway. So biblical Christianity from this time period becomes more and more secular and marginalized, which gives rise to this brazen idea of the human. The human needs to be the center of everything that we do. And so you've got the Humanist Manifesto that was released in 1933. And we do not have the time for me to go over this in detail, so I'm going to ask you to take it, look over it yourself, because I think I've got it here in total. Yes, I do, including the signatories that are on it. The signatories are interesting because it's a bunch of liberal preachers and academicians that promoted this idea. But it was basically the idea that religion, old-fashioned religion, has run its course. It is superstitious. It is not helpful. It is not needful. And therefore, we need to start promoting the human religion. So one of their first principles was religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created. So the universe has always been. Humanism believes that man is a part of nature and that he's emerged as a result of continuous process. So God did not create him, he just happened. Because they hold an organic view of life, humanists find that the traditional dualism of mind and body must be rejected. In Christianity, we usually think of ourselves as being a tripart being. They mention it as being dualistic, which is basically you have a physical side and then you have a spiritual side, and the two need to be in harmony with one another. But with the humanists, they believe you've only got one side, your body. And so all that matters is what's going on in the here and now for you as an individual, and the only thing that really matters beyond that is what's good for the human race as a whole. And so all of the humanists believe that religion should consist of promoting the human race. So you help people now live their lives in such a way that humanity later will be benefited. And this is the religion that you see promoted in the government. This is why Roosevelt, not this Roosevelt, but the other Roosevelt, grabbed large acres of land. Because you see, land belongs to the entire human race, and therefore it needs to be protected from individuals perhaps abusing it or misusing it for the future. How many of you have heard the phrase, the world belongs to our grandchildren? Heard that? That's the progressive humanist idea, is you need to make choices now because of the benefit of the human race in the future. And so it's the larger group, not the individual, that counts. And you'll find that as you go through the Humanist Manifesto, all the things that are involved in that. All right, so comments, questions real quick here at the end. Yeah. Say that again. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Radio, of course, was the high tech of that time period. And so I think he's almost kind of a counter to the fundamentalist type stuff. But also you've got, we didn't talk a ton about it, but socialism gets started around the beginning of the 1900s as well. And so many Americans started promoting socialism. And of course, that's what Nazi stands for. It's the National Socialist Party. In Germany. And so he was just doing what was happening all over the place at that time, promoting the idea of socialism, which again is the idea the group is more important than the individual. Right? And so that is a philosophy that is pushed hard in opposition to Christianity. Biblical Christianity teaches that Jesus died for the individual. That Jesus wants a personal relationship with the individual, that the individual is responsible for his or her own behavior. and needs to make proper choices based on the relationship with Christ. But socialism does not believe that, neither does progressivism. Progressivism is all about the group, which is why you should be irritated when your kids come back from school talking about, they put me in a group for a group grade, and we're doing this as a group and that as a group, and isn't it important that, you know, the world is more important as a whole than I am as an individual? It's part of the propaganda. Well, they just say it's superstition and mythology. And it's promoted all the time on the public broadcasting system stuff. Joseph Campbell, he's dead now, so he knows better. But he had been preaching and teaching a long time this idea of the mythology, that Christianity is just another mythology. And so just like we used to learn about Zeus and Apollo and all those guys, and they were just, you know, made up stories, that's just Christianity. And we need to get used to that and just move on. It's cute when you're a kid, but as an adult, you shouldn't believe any of it. And so that's what's being taught. And part of public school, and definitely part of undergraduate school, college, and beyond, is to try to re-teach those that have been taught religious ideas, Christian ideas, earlier in their life, to try to get them to abandon them and embrace the progressive mindset, that this is all about the group, it's all about the species, it's all about the government being good for us and best for us. It's not good. You know, our founding fathers basically looked at government as being a big vicious dog that needed to be kept on a chain, except for those few times it needs to be needed, such as, you know, defense of the country as a group. The rest of the time it needed to be in its cage because it was dangerous. You remember Ronald Reagan's comment. He says, the scariest words to ever hear is, I'm here from the government to help. No, I'm not. Government is not the solution to the problem. It is the problem in most cases. And that's historically true. Now, you know, it sounds like I'm being really, really political about this, but this is part of the fight against biblical Christianity. The founding fathers tended to be biblical Christian persons. And they put extreme control upon government because of their fear that it would get out of control. And that has now been flipped on its head, that you've got to take the bands off so the government can do things for you. Folks, if government can do things for you, it can do things to you. And that's what the people found out during the early 1900s. Okay.
Since you don't have government,
yeah, that was the local government was supposed to be taking care of that. That was the ideal of the founding fathers, was each of the local regions would take care of their own needs because they better understand what those needs are. Same thing with education, stuff like that. That was their picture of it. It wasn't until the progressive era that it became more of the federal government needs to control all of that. And that's, you know, of course, that also brings into place bureaucracy, and bureaucracy eats up tax dollars, and then of course you need more taxes, and it's just a mess. All right, so we'll leave that, and then next week we'll get into how things kind of started moving into what we usually refer to as the more modern era, you know, World War II and after, we think of it as the more modern era, and how things changed with that.